This evening, we're kind of in a transition place here. Now, my burden when we started this was to talk about, to do some teaching from Daniel and Revelation both. They are both written how? How are they unique from a lot of the other writings in the scripture? I'm gonna do a little review here. Speak up. Okay, it's prophetic, and what do we call that? Okay, it is symbolic. What's the word we put? Prophecy, and it's written how? If you open up the book of Revelation at the top of your Bible, it should say. Apocalyptic. Okay? It's the apocalyptic writing, which means what? What does that word apocalyptic mean? I thought we were doing a review. it's part of it, but the apocalypse, a lot of times people talk about the apocalypse as being the end, but that is just part of it. The word itself means the unveiling. Or something that was hidden, okay, something that was hidden was unveiled. And that's what the apocalypse or the apocalyptic writing, it's something being unveiled that was hidden. Daniel wrote that way. Ezekiel, if you will read Ezekiel 1 and 2, it might cause you to blink a few times. There's some apocalyptic writing there. It's in symbols about the Ezekiel's will. Y'all might have heard that song, Ezekiel's Will. And one of the visions, partly that's in Ezekiel, we're going to read about in the fourth chapter of Revelation. And so if you have studied Ezekiel, when you start reading about it in Revelation 4, it's like, okay, I've seen this somewhere before. That's where it came from. What is the reason why Daniel, as well as John the Revelator, and again, it was because God gave them these visions, okay? They didn't just pull these out of thin air, but God gave them visions. Why do you think it was in symbolic language? Okay, but a lot of the other writings in the scripture is just... Okay. What would be one of the reasons, taking into consideration what was going on in Daniel's time and what he was prophesying, as well as what the book of Revelation talks about? What was happening to God's people? Persecution, right? Now, if they would have had a scroll that said, this king is going to do this and this is going to happen, and they possessed that, they would be brought to trial, put to death, and prosecuted, okay? Prosecuted, put to death, persecuted. But part of what, in symbols, you can't do that. I mean, it's like, if the symbols were passed around and the Jews understood what it meant, they couldn't be brought to trial by the pagans or by the kings of these ancient kingdoms that we studied about in Daniel. So that's one of the other things I think it's important to recognize, that symbols, it stood for something that was God revealed to His people, and it was something they could understand. But what the message of Daniel did and what the message of Revelation does, it is a message of the battle between good and evil. It reveals a lot of history, but it's not just any history. It's a history as it pertains to the people of God, all right? So there's a lot of things that it doesn't tell us about, a lot of historical events, but it tells us about God's people, and it was a message of hope to God's people. When John was on the Isle of Patmos, and he sent these messages to the seven churches of Asia, in this symbolic writing, it was a message of hope to these people as well. To those that were staying faithful, it was, if you're persecuted, don't give up hope because there's still a kingdom. If your loved ones are put to death, God is still on His throne. Multiple places in Revelation, we see a picture of what's happening in heaven while there's trouble on earth, we see a picture of the martyrs up in heaven glorifying God. Okay? So we, or paradise, if you will. But we see the souls of those that have been faithful. We see a victorious church up in heaven, while on earth we see a picture of the church being persecuted. All right? So it was a message of hope, and I think it's important for us to understand with Daniel Revelation that it is a message of hope to those people at those time periods, as it should be for us today. I know we're getting very few in number, but when you get a vision, and I believe it takes the, where's our chart? Or it takes the Word and the Spirit of God, and what do we call those together? The Word and the Spirit. The two witnesses, all right? We're gonna cover it in Revelation, but the two witnesses, they bear witness of God the Father. It's the Word of God and the Spirit of God. And we need the Word, the Spirit of the Lord to open up our eyes to Revelation, because it should give courage to us in the last days. We can start feeling like we're few and there's so much compromise. And sometimes you may start feeling like the prophet that was just felt like he was the only one left. But the message of Revelation is a message of hope during times of persecution, during times that there are just a few. It's saying don't give up hope, be faithful to the Lord, and you're going to have a crown of life if you'll just hold on. So, That is a very brief summary of what these messages are about. And that was the message to the Jews during the time that Daniel wrote. Couple interesting facts. The book of Daniel was written in two different languages. All right? Different chapters were written in different languages. Because keep in mind, Daniel didn't just sit down necessarily and just write all these chapters like we have them. All right? But chapters 1 to the, through 2, chapter 2 in the third verse, was written in Hebrew. So who do you think that was primarily for? The Jews, right? And then we find that chapters 2, verse 4, to chapter 7, verse 28, was written in Aramaic. So who do you think that was for? It's for a much more widespread audience. It wasn't just to the Jews, but it was for the people of that time. He wanted them to read it. And then we come to chapter 8 and chapter 12, and it was written again to the Hebrews. In other words, the message that he was giving was kind of, some of it was more for the Jews, to let them know what's happening, to let them know the prophecy, some of the prophecies of Christ, and let them know of the hope that was going to be there for them, but some of it was also written in Aramaic. Chapter 2 to chapter 7. Remember, where did this vision come from? What chapter was this? It was chapter 7, right? That was chapter 7. And so that was widespread. Do you remember me telling you that when Alexander the Great came to Jerusalem, that the priest met him outside of Jerusalem with some of the writings of Daniel? Chapter 7. Here, O king. Here, Alexander, I'd like you to read this scroll. Look at this. And it was, and notice, he did not, even in these kingdoms, he did not name them out. All right? By the symbols, it's much more easily understood. But in chapter 8, he literally named out who he was talking about. Now, chapter 8 is this picture here with the goat and the ram, all right? And this is chapter 8, and he literally spells out what these kingdoms were. So there's no mystery. And it correlates with everything that we already learned from chapter 7 and the great image right here. It correlates with this, but he was very specific to the Jews in chapter 8. Now, what we do right now is up to what you know, I guess. In this vision that Daniel had of chapter 8, what does the ram represent? Does anybody remember? Guess once more and you'll probably get it. Huh? No? Yeah. The ram represents, we're going to read a few verses out of chapter 8. The ram represents the Medes and the Persians, and the goat represents... It represents the goat, right? Okay, and there's some horns there. So I want us just before we, and this will be the last really focus on Daniel will be tonight. I didn't know if we would move on or not, but I think it would be good to just do a brief reminder, and then there's a more in-depth study that if the Lord opens up the door later on, we may revisit it. There's some of the prophetic time and the history of a king that is relevant to chapters 11 and chapter 12 that we're not going to take time to get into. It gets a little bit more intense. And I think for our purposes in this study, we're not going to get as deep. In chapter 8, if you will open your Bible, someone read verses 1 to 3 for us, if you would. Daniel chapter 8, verse 1 to 3. Right, let's stop there for a moment. He said in the third year of the reign of Belshazzar, this vision that Daniel had that came from chapter 8 was around 551 to 553 BC. And it was 2 years after the vision of chapter 7, okay? So he'd had this vision, and then 2 years later, he had this vision here that we're reading about in chapter 8. So just keep in mind that time frame. Daniel was about 70 years old at this point, all right? And this was about 12 to 15 years. Again, the history and dates get a little bit muddled. But it was about 12 to 15 years before Cyrus, who was what nationality? He was a Persian. Before Cyrus the Persian overthrew the Babylonian Empire. So just for context, all right, just for context, that was 2 years after the vision of chapter 7. Daniel was about 70 years old, and it was about 12 to 15 years before Cyrus overthrew the Babylonian Empire. So let's take note. He talked about Shushan. Does that name ring any bells with anybody from another very interesting Bible story in the Old Testament? Shushan. Shushan became, just a little background, Shushan became the capital of Persia, okay? It became the capital of Persia after the time of Cyrus. Again, it obviously was a royal city, and so the story of the book of Esther takes place there, all right? So just to give you a little bit of context, this was after the Babylonian Empire had been overthrown by the Medes and the Persians. We read about it was during that time then later that the Jews were able to leave Babylon, right? But before then, remember while they were still in Babylon, Queen Esther was there, and they were trying to kill some of the Jews, and she intervened. Well, that took place in Shushan, where Daniel had this vision of. So it was a very specific vision. This is not pulling things out of thin air. That's what I want to stress to you all, that some prophecy, maybe we don't understand it, but other of it is very, very clear in what's being said. It was also there that Nehemiah was the cupbearer, remember, to the king? That was also in Shushan. So there's a lot of historical things that went on, even scripturally. He was sitting down by the river of Ulai, which was a river in Persia, and he saw a vision of a ram. Now, if you look up here, you see the ram, and how many horns does it have? Yeah, two horns, and the two horns were high. So what do you think that might represent? There are two horns, But one of the horns was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. In other words, there's this ram, and what would a ram symbolize, okay? Is it something spiritual, or is it something political, civil, what? Something political, right? We learn that in chapter 7, okay? When it was something, when, and this is important in our understanding the symbolic language, when it was something from animal life, it normally had to do with something civil or political, okay? But if you will also recall from chapter 7, there was a little horn that grew out of this horrible, terrible beast, right? There was a little horn, and that horn had eyes to see and a mouth to speak. And what did that horn represent? This was only a week ago, or a week and a half ago. What was it? It was popery, right? It was Roman Catholicism. And so keep in mind that when it had a characteristics of humans, the ability to talk like a man or see as a man, we look to the ecclesiastical realm for the key to interpretation. Okay? So here we have a ram, so we're going to start thinking along the lines of what? A nation. Okay? So we have this nation, and there were two horns. And what were the horns? What did the horns represent in our visions in chapter 7? Kings, right? Rulers, authority. So now we have this kingdom or something political, and there's two horns, and it said one of them was longer than the other, but it came up last. In other words, it was growing. Had two horns, but one was getting longer until it was longer than the other one. All right? Now, let us just, because of time, the Lord gave the interpretation of this in the same chapter. In verse 20, he said, "The ram that thou sawest, having two horns, are the kings of Media and Persia." So he tells us, this isn't just assumption. The vision that Daniel had of the ram and the goat fighting, if you will, he said that the ram that you saw are the kings of Medes and Persian. And remember, we already talked about which of those kingdoms became more powerful in the end. Who was it? Yes. Yeah. Persia became stronger eventually. It wasn't to start with, but eventually it became stronger politically. And you can just open the history books and find that out. But that's what was revealed to Daniel. All right, he went on to say, "I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward so that no beast could stand before him," no beast, no kingdom could stand before the Medes and the Persians. They were out conquering. And he said, "Neither was there any that would deliver out of his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. As I was considering, I beheld a he-goat." Now, in the other visions that Daniel had all previously had, keep in mind that the Medo-Persian Empire was represented by what? Was an animal like a bear? Remember, that was raised up on one side? Remember? So it was a different analogy. It was a different analogy sending a similar type message. It was silver in the great image, in the vision that Nebuchadnezzar had. It was silver. It was the bear in the vision of chapter 7. And now we see here, there's a little key here to understand. In chapter 8, the vision was of a ram. All right? With the two horns. Of note, and I think this is interesting, the sign for Persia is Aries. That's their zodiac sign. Do you know what that is? Take a wild stab in the dark. It's a ram. All right? So there's a reason for the symbols. Before we even get there, there's this goat that comes on the scene in the next verse. Do you have any idea what the symbol for Greece is? It's a goat. They pushed westward, and I'm not going to go through all the history of it, of their expansion of the Medo-Persian Empire. But in verse 5, it said, I was considering, and behold, a he-goat from the west. Where did the goat come from? What direction? From the west. The Grecians came from the west of the whole earth and touched not the ground, and a goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Now it said that the goat touched not the ground. What do you think that would represent? Yeah, it's moving fast. And remember, over here, it had the six wings was, or no, the four of a fowl. Remember? So it was moving very quickly, very rapidly. And here it said the goat, it didn't even touch the ground. It was just moving fast. And there was a notable horn. In other words, there might have been some others, but the focus was there was a notable horn on this goat. So that horn, who was the notable horn from the Grecian Empire? It was Alexander the Great. And remember, he conquered a lot of the known world. Not all of it, but he conquered a lot of it in what was like less than 12 years. So there was no time to stop and rest. I mean, they were moving. They were conquering. Just of note again, the emblem of the Macedonians is a one-horned goat. All right? That is the sign or the emblem of the Macedonians. The Aegean Sea, where Greece is, it means the goat sea. So there's a reason, again, there's a reason for these symbols. Zodiac sign again is Capricorn, which is the goat. Capper means goat, and cornu means horn. So it's the same thing. All of these symbols just dovetail together. Touch not the ground, again, denoted the swiftness of the goat. Notable horn, we already talked about, was Alexander the Great. One of the greatest military leaders ever recorded in history was Alexander the Great. Just to review, how old was he when he died? Just shy of 33. So he was 32 years old. Just shy of 33. And then we read, and I'm not going to cover it right now just for the sake of our time, but down through he had more information. He said, I saw a he-goat come from the west. He had a notable horn, and he came to the ram that had two horns. I'm reading from verse 6. He came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran into him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close under the ram, and he was moved with choler against him, and smote the ram, and brake his two horns. And there was no power in the ram to stand before him, but he cast him to the ground and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. That's talking about the conquest of the Grecians against the Medes and the Persians. There was a great defeat in that battle. And he tells us over in, let me look at what verse. Verse 21, it said, the rough goat is the king of Grecia, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. Now that being broken, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. This is prophecy. This is like reading out of a text history book. All right? This is prophecy, though. God gave, and people don't believe the Bible. And this was written before this happened. And in the latter, there's not much clearer prophecy than this and the image. And in the latter time of their kingdom, where the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding, and we're going to get there in a second. So there were four horns, okay? There were four horns on this, but the notable one was Alexander the Great. And then what were the other four? They were the generals. When after Alexander the Great died, the Macedonian Empire, Grecian Empire, was divided up between his four generals. But as God prophesied, none of them were near as strong as the first. All right? So this was all extremely clear. Now, one of the things I did want us to get out of this vision, and the next part, I told you, to be careful about what you read about Revelation. You know, if you decide to go to Mardell's and pick out a book and say, okay, I'll see what this means over in Daniel chapter 8 and 11 and 12, there's a lot of false stuff written on these. Working on a print shop book, or a book that was printed by the print shop. It was an old, put out by the Gospel Trumpet, I think, years and years ago. And I just happened to open it up. It was actually on some of Revelation. I was going through working on some things on the books. And I opened it up and started reading, and it was talking about this passage, and it wasn't right. It was incorrect. And I'm going to explain the reason why. And the point I'm making is you have to be very careful. All right? And now let's read a little bit here. In verse 8, the he-goat waxed great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken, for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. Okay, the four winds of heaven would be the four quarters of the earth, okay? That's talking about from the north, south, east, and west. All right, so they divided up the empire. But then let's read on what he said. And out of one of them. Now, this is a key point to understanding Daniel and Revelation, but it said one out of one of them. Out of one of what? Yeah. There were four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven, okay? The great horn was broken, it said, and for it came up four notable ones. So like there were another four horns that came up. But it said out of one of them. That's a fifth horn, right? It wasn't talking about one of those four. It said out of one of them came forth a little horn which waxed exceeding great toward the south, the east, and toward the pleasant land. It waxed great even to the host of heaven, and cast some of the host and the stars to the ground and stomped upon it. He magnified himself as the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down, and a host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and it prospered. Then he had a vision of one saint saying to another, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? And he said unto me, unto 2,300 days, there then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. And it came to pass that when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and sought for the meaning, beheld, there stood before me as the appearance of a man, and then the Lord or the angel began to give some of the interpretation. All right? Over in the interpretation, in the latter part of the 8th chapter, it said, the king that was broken, whereas four stood up, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. And in the latter time of their kingdom. Isn't that pretty clear? Now, what kingdom are we talking about with the goat? Okay, this is the Grecian Empire. He said it. We're not imagining things. We're not pulling stuff out of thin air. I don't know. This is so badly mangled in prophetic teaching. It said it came that there was a notable horn. Who was that? Alexander the Great. It's easy to be understood, isn't it? Historically, this is clear. When that horn was broken, there became four notable ones came up. That was the four generals that the Macedonian Empire was split up. The scripture very clearly says, In the latter days of this kingdom, or these kings, there was another little horn that rose out from among them. Isn't that what it said? So the question is, who is this little horn? Because this little horn, did you take note of what he did? It said he cast the stars down from out of heaven and trod them down. He stopped the sacrifices. There was a desolation. There's an abomination. This was the abomination of desolation. That's what this was. And if you want to go home and read chapter 11 and chapter 12, chapter 11 just gives more detail about this little horn. That's what chapter 11 does. We're not going to study it in this series. So the big question is, who is the little horn? There are many people, some people would say, well, that's the Pope. Because remember over here, that little horn that came up that had a mouth to speak and eyes to see, that was popery, right? That was Roman Catholicism. All right, but what was this beast? And where did the Pope come out of? Okay, what empire are we talking about over here? Greece. So could that be the Pope? Well, the little horn that did so many mighty things from chapter 7, surely it's the same in chapter 8. No, it's not. Very clearly, it's not the same. All right? So this little horn, it said here, and again, oh, it's hard to stop when you get into this. But this little horn, it said, a host was given him against the daily sacrifice. And then the saints, it said, it talked about the stars being cast down from heaven. What do you think that might mean? What is a star? Okay, it's in Revelation chapter 1. It talks about the stars that, again, were in the hand of Christ, were the angels, right, or the messengers. So that is one definition or symbol of a star. What did God promise Abraham about his descendants? They'd be as numerous as the stars in the sky, all right? So we're talking about a political entity here. Now, with symbolic language, you have to take the context of it, okay? Because sometimes there are multiple meanings of stars. But here, we find a political entity casting stars down out of heaven and trampling them, and we hear the saints saying, how long is this going to go on? So what do you think might that mean? Yeah, it was not near as powerful as Alexander the Great, but it rose out of the Greek Empire. So keep this in mind. When it begins to talk about this little horn, it said here, and I'm reading from verse 23 down, just going to summarize. It said, in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king, he tells us it's a king, a fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. His power will be mighty, but not by his own power. He will destroy wonderfully and shall prosper and practice and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. So whoever this was, casting down the stars, he was destroying the Jews. All right? God's people of the time. He was destroying them, persecuting them, killing them. And it said, and through his policy, he shall cause craft to prosper. He shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many, and shall stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. And the vision of the evening and morning which was told is true, wherefore shut thou up the vision, for it shall be for many days. And it said, and I, Daniel, fainted and was sick certain days. Afterward I rose up and did the king's business, and I was astonished at the vision, but none understood it. They didn't understand it right then. But do you know when they did begin to understand it? When they saw the fulfillment, when it started happening, then they understood what was going on. So, this little horn that came from the Grecian, anytime you read that the little horn out of Daniel 8 is the same out of Daniel 7, no, you might as well close the book. All right? Because the Pope came out of Rome, not out of the Grecian Empire, which means for us to understand it today, we have to look back and say, okay, after Alexander the Great died, during the time of the Grecian kingdoms, what happened where a lot of the Jews were persecuted, and it must have been pretty fierce because, again, you can read chapter 11, and he goes through and he gives a lot more description about this king, all right? He told us it was a king. Said he would stand up and rule with great dominion. He talks about a lot of specific conquests. He talks about the corruption. It's all through chapter 11. He's explaining this little horn. This horn was Antiochus, all right? It was Antiochus who began reigning in 175 B.C., all right? 175 B.C., and he was the eighth of 26 kings that ruled over the Syrian portion of Alexander's empire. So, Alexander, he dies, the big horn, the notable horn is broken, there's four other horns, and from amongst them, another little horn shows up. And then it starts giving us a description of that fifth horn, all right? That fifth horn was Antiochus. And his last name is Epiphanes, which means the illustrious one or a great manifestation of God. That's what his name means. The Romans and Jews kind of twisted the name and called him Epimenes, which is the madman. So they took the word, kind of changed a little bit. They called him a madman. It's paralleled all through here. So the king, fierce countenance, stood up. Now, have you all heard about the Maccabees? The Maccabees were during this time, okay? So the book of the Maccabees, and Kylie, this gets to something you brought up Sunday about canonization, all right? The word canon actually means, it comes from the Greek word a reed or a cane. It's also used, the word means rule, okay, or measure. So a canon is the rule of measurement. So when we talk about the Bible being a closed canon, it's closed canon. What we're saying is this is the measurement. These books that we have in our Bible, when you say it's a closed canon, this is the book, this is the rule of measurement. So there are other books. The book of the Maccabees, a lot of history in it. Josephus, he was a historian. There's a lot of things we learn from them, but they're not included in the Bible. Some of the Dead Sea Scrolls. I know Brother Stover, some of you remember him or remember of him. But Brother Stover apparently studied quite a bit of that, and after studying a lot of some of those Dead Sea Scrolls, he was very convinced that they didn't belong in the Bible. And God knew what he was doing. God used sinful man to bring these scrolls together in the book that we call the Bible today. But God knew what he was doing. So it doesn't mean we can't learn from other sources, but this is our rule of faith. Not anything else. So out of the book of Maccabees, you can read the Jewish that wrote about the Maccabees. This was during the time that Antiochus, and what Antiochus did, and I just want to try to summarize here, as the host of heaven, he cast down, he was powerful. So the heaven was not up in the in the celestial heavens, right? He was a mighty host. He was, it was in the sense that he was powerful and he was strong, and he went and he persecuted the Jews. All right. So when he marched into Jerusalem, and there's a lot of prophecy that's in this, but we'll just say when he marched into Jerusalem, he went into the temple. He took out some of the things out of the temple. But what he did was he set up a false god on the altar of the God of Israel. Okay? He set up a god on that, and then he offered a sacrifice of a swine, which was unclean, and it, swine's blood was on the altar of our God, and there's an image of the false god on that altar. That is the abomination of desolation. Seventh-day Adventists and others have taken these prophecies and tried to look at going out in the future with the return of the Lord. And when the God didn't return, they thought it was going to be in the 1800s. When God didn't return, they said, well, there must have been a cleansing up in heaven that took place because it didn't happen here on earth. Instead of just saying, yeah, we were wrong. This happened during the time of the Maccabees. When the Maccabees themselves, there was an old priest, and he was a Maccabee, and there was an old priest that they were forced to offer sacrifices to their gods, and this old priest refused to do it. And so they called another Jew. The Jews were giving in to this pagan influence, and one of the Jews stepped up and he went to offer it, and that old priest got so angry that he killed that Jew and the other official in the town, and that's what started the Maccabean revolt. It was Jews that came together, and it was almost a civil war. In a sense, it was a civil war because a lot of the Jews were just falling in under this Grecian influence. Paganism, false gods, and so that began the Maccabean revolt. But it's very interesting, at least to me, that this is during the time that we refer to as the 400 years of what? Silence. God did not send a prophet for 400 years. And then we read of John the Baptist was one of the first ones God had sent with a message again from heaven. But yet we find in the temple, who was in the temple worshiping God during the time when Christ was born? Simeon and Anna and Zechariah was there as well. And when they brought baby Jesus, he said, mine eyes have seen the salvation of the Lord. Mine eyes have seen. We found after 400 years of God not sending a prophet, it was silence to the Jewish people. It was during this time period. This is part of that 400 years. There were still people that were being faithful to God. And I wonder about us. We say, Lord, we need some big reformation. We need you to come in. Are we going to be the ones found in the temple, still serving God faithfully until the Lord sees fit to come back? That encourages me. That inspires me. But the Maccabean revolt, that was what it was about. And that was during the time of Antiochus, this king, in the abomination of desolation was when he went into the temple at Jerusalem and he set up a false god on the altar of the Lord, and then he offered the sacrifice of the swine sacrifice, and the blood flowed on the altar. All right? There are, again, in this context, he said, let me read here. He said he would come, let me find it. Be sure I'm in the right chapter. No, I'm in chapter 11. 11 gives a lot more detail, and we're not going to work through verse by verse. Verse 11 in chapter 8, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away. Okay, verse 10. It waxed great even to the host of heaven and cast down some of the hosts and of the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. Now, a celestial being, okay, because we read about this in Revelation as well. A celestial being has referred to as leaders, civil leaders in authority, but it also can refer in a spiritual sense of God's people, or in Revelation, we read about fallen stars. We have to look at the context to see if it's talking about fallen politically, or is it talking about someone that had one time been a light for the Lord and is now imbibed in false doctrine has fallen. Mm-hmm. Yes. Right. And he put his own priest in place. Yeah. Right. Yeah. It was one of, and I have that in my study, but I didn't know we'd get that deep. But yes, he did come, Antiochus did come, and he kicked out the priest that was there, and then he had someone else come in his stead, and then there was a big problem between there, and then when the temple was restored, they went and tried to get a real priest to come back. So that was all more of the history. So if you're interested in it, there's places you can read and get the history of it. But in this time, there's a lot of controversy between the Jews because the Greek influence was, what kind of influence do you think they had? Yeah, I mean, it was a dual thing because there's a lot of education. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, educationally and literature and architecture and even government. There's a lot of things that you could say, oh, there's nothing wrong with it. But there was a lot of loose living, a lot very, they were pagan still. They weren't worshiping God. And they were really pushing the Grecian influence. It probably still affects people today. I mean, it was very widespread. And so the Jews were affected by it too. So you have the Jews that are saying, we don't want to give in to this influence. And others are saying, we want to serve the Lord. And others were going more to the Grecian way of life. And so automatically you've got this difference of culture that starts building in. I think we have the same thing today. Yeah, we want to be progressive. We say, well, the saints just aren't a progressive people. And you know what? I don't think we all have to live on a farm, being an agrarian society, to be saints of God, okay? That means we can live in the city and have those kinds of jobs as well, and we can all serve the Lord. But there's a danger. There's a danger in this progressive thinking that we need to, you know, we're living like in the 1800s. Well, are we living in the 1800s, or are we living like the Bible teaches, and as the world gets worse and worse, we're going to be more and more separate from the world? In our dress, in our conduct, in what we do, there's going to be a difference. And this is part of the Battle of Armageddon that we're facing today. Revelation brings that out. But the same thing happened amongst the Jews with this thinking. I like that word, progressive. It really wasn't progressive. It was getting them further and further away from God. Mm-hmm. Yes, in Corinth. That's right. They actually welcomed it because they said, oh, there's another God. We haven't heard of this God of Israel. Tell us about him. Until he started to say, this is the God of all gods. Yes. But with that, although it might have been intellectual pleasure, look at the Greek philosophers. And something I don't think I mentioned, everybody. I know I mentioned it at home. Do you know who taught Alexander the Great when he was a boy? Aristotle. The Greek philosopher, Aristotle. He was the one that taught Alexander the Great. They were into lots of different fleshly so-called pleasures. And so, I mean, it was just almost a hedonistic, in a sense. You could put it on an educated robe if you want, but it was still fulfilling the flesh in lots of different ways. Yeah. Yep. We won't get in the time again of what Zachary brought up about the priest. I have the information here, but I think for our purposes, Jason, actually, that was one of the priests. He was ousted, and his brother Jason, or Joshua, was the one that Antiochus put in as the priest. They turned Jerusalem almost into a Greek-like city. All right? They were turning it in to be more like a Greek city, adopting Greek fashions, the Greek language, the Greek games, nude sports competitions, gymnasiums, all of that. The Olympics, where that come from? Greece. I'll just say this. You look at the symbolism of what still goes on in the Olympics, and I can just tell you this, it didn't come from the God of heaven. The torch that you run with and all of these practices, it was pagan to the core. It was pagan to the core. And we're living a time where probably, I don't know, I hope no one here has, but I want us to get a point here, that there may be some young people or some families today in the saints, oh yeah, the Olympics and we're going to go be a part of this and do this. There's a reason why. And it's not just because of the history. Don't misunderstand me. Because Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, these are names after Greek gods, Greek and Roman gods too, right? So we say, well, we're not going to call it Wednesday because that's after a god. So it's not just the history, but we want to look at the spirit that's behind it. Look at what's driving it, and we want to talk about modern day idolatry. People are sacrificing themselves on the altar of sports. This is where it came from. That's enough said on that. Maybe not, but anyway, Antiochus removed Jason as high priest then in 172 and installed someone else. Because the tribute, yeah, Menelaus gave him a lot amount of tribute money. So the rebellion against Jason, that was the Maccabees, when they heard, this is what happened, when they heard that Antiochus was dead, the Jews rejoiced, and Jason, the previous priest, he raised an army. He raised another army and attacked Jerusalem to try to regain his office. Antiochus hadn't died, and he returned to Jerusalem from Egypt. And he killed 80,000 Jews in 3 days. And 40,000 were sold into slavery. So when we talk about casting down stars and trotting them under, and then we hear the saints saying, how long is this going to last? That's what it's talking about. I could read to you from the Maccabees. I have a few quotes here. But just the history of that time that was recorded, it goes along exactly with what's being taught here. So then, in short, what? Okay? He tells us, and this would get us into, he said here that it would last when they ask up in heaven, how long will this last? How long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice? Because once Antiochus came into Jerusalem in the temple, there were no more daily sacrifices offered to God there. Okay? So the sacrifices stopped. They ceased. And he said, how long will the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? And he said, unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. This is what the abomination of desolation is, okay? And again, chapter 11 just gives more information about it. Definition. Abomination is the common name for idol in the Old Testament. All right? The abomination of desolation. Abomination is a word for idol in the Old Testament. And actually, just, I have a little more information here. He actually, the idol that he put up on the altar was Jupiter Olympus. And that's what was erected. The god of Jupiter Olympus was the god they put up in the temple. And the daily sacrifices stopped. The Jews were won over by Antiochus and the Greek influence. They left worshiping God. And that, again, was when the Maccabean revolt took place. And then the cleansing of the sanctuary is when the Jews came back in and reclaimed the temple for God. That was the cleansing of the sanctuary. Again, there are people that will point to another age or another dispensation. And I have some more kind of interesting ecclesiastical history about the Seventh-day Adventists. They thought that 2,300, they said it was 2,300 years, and they thought that Christ would return in 1843. When Christ didn't show up, he recalculated and said he messed up. said it was going to be 1844. Well, the Lord didn't come back in 1844 either. And so then they just concluded that the cleansing referred to the cleansing of the earth and that something was going up on in heaven. And then they revised their whole theology. But that was the foundation of Seventh-day Adventists, just for the record. That's what that stemmed from. That was where it stemmed from. So the cleansing of the sanctuary was 2,300, he said, 2,300 days. Now, I'm not going to get into the, into all of the specific dates because it gets really complicated. For those of you that remember how many years ago, 7 years ago, we went over some of this and I actually wrote out all the specific years and months and days and we went through and we looked at that. It gets very complicated. F.G. Smith and Riggle and Warner, they calculated and looked at the 2,300 days being from the time of the incursion of Jerusalem by Antiochus to his death. All right? It was 2,300 days, a 30-day calendar year. All right? I mean, month. 30 days a month, so 360 days. 360 days, divide that into 2,300. That's how many years it was. And it actually works out, but there is a second understanding that actually I think is even more specific to that prophecy. And, referencing the 2,300, he's asking about the sacrifices, and there was a morning and an evening sacrifice, okay? There was a morning and an evening sacrifice. And, it was interrupted by Antiochus' desecration of the daily sacrifice. So if you look at how many sacrifices were missed, okay, it would cover 1,150 days, all right? It would cover 100, so that it would cover 1,150 days. And that is the exact amount of time of the desecration when he put up the god of Jupiter, I believe it was. Did I say Jupiter? Not Jupiter. Who was it I said? Yeah. To the time that the actual temple was cleansed and restored. That was 1,150 days. So that would cover it more exact looking at the number of sacrifices. And there's a couple of, interpretations of the translation in the Greek of those words that there's a strong case to be made when they said 2,300 days that was referring to the evening and the morning. Okay? And that would be it. And if not, like I said, in some of our literature, it talks about from the date of Antiochus coming into Jerusalem, I believe the first time, to the day of his death. In I believe it's in the 11th and 12th chapter of Daniel, it talks about 2,290 days, and that left, and when you calculate everything out, it leaves a few days left. Well, there was a period of time that Antiochus was on his deathbed before he died. He was sick for a period of time, and a lot of people think that period of time makes up the remainder of days. So, but the 2,300 is literal. It's literal. And when you look at the history, it's really amazing. Although you say, okay, was it from the first incursion to the cleansing of the sanctuary, or was it the number of daily of sacrifices, morning and evening sacrifices, 1,150? That's pretty amazing. So this was a very specific, amazing prophecy. There are a lot of people that talk about the cleansing, and I've got a whole page of dates and things, but I doubt anybody wants them. But it was very amazing when you look at the cleansing of the sanctuary, when the abomination of desolation took place. Know this, the abomination of desolation was when they set up the false god on it by Antiochus, and it came out of this kingdom. So people that try to put it for 2,300 years, a day for a year, because again, that's one way to understand prophetic time, right? This one it wasn't. He said it came from this kingdom, and he gave an explanation. You look back in history, and you're left with a pretty much a wow factor. All right? If you're not trying to prove anything. You're just taking it as the history says it and as it makes it. It's pretty amazing. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he did because he knew what God had said about Nebuchadnezzar's being in, as an animal, insane when he lost his mind for a time, times, and dividing of times, yes. And then the other scriptures I gave the other day about that, you shall be in the wilderness for 40 days, each day for a year. And then there's another one in Ezekiel that says, Now sometimes it is, and you will find in Revelation, we'll find in Revelation the same thing. It's told in different ways. It all comes up to a same time period. And you just look at history and see what happens. So here he said 2,300 days, and how do we know what it was? Just looking back in history. But he told us where they came from, he told us what happened, and we can look and see it, and it's just an amazing prophecy. So that's Daniel. If you like more of it, if you want the history, there's more of it out there you can study about Antiochus, but just remember, be careful about picking up prophetic literature. That's all I can say, because there's a lot of false doctrines that come from these teachings, and especially all these teachings over here. So this little horn, is this horn, the little horn that came up out of the goat, is it the same horn that came out of this fourth beast over here? No. Very clearly, it's not. Otherwise, that horn would have come out of this beast right here, right? The four-headed leopard. So. Any questions?